SBS live streams and podcasts are supported by advertising.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, and welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandami ngaya. I am Bertrand Tungandami.
And Wadamuli, I'm Kerry Lee Harding.
Coming up in your program this Friday, the 17th of May, while social and support sectors have expressed mixed reactions to the 2024-2025 federal budget delivered earlier this week. Also in the program, Ngalama songman Patrick Chanside shares insights into his groundbreaking theatre production, Chubby Flat Country, debuting its tour in Nam later today. And ever wondered what is the emotional toll after being on the front line of history? In the program today, Alan Lee from SBS's newsroom shares his experience at reporting trauma. All these stories and more coming to you on NITV Radio after the latest news brought to you by Kerry Lee Harding.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
In this bulletin, statue of former Premier who mutilated an Aboriginal man toppled ahead of court hearing about its removal. And Peter Dutton outlines a plan to ease the housing crises in the opposition's budget reply speech, calling to reduce permanent migration. And South Africa urges the United Nations top court to order a halt to Israel's offensive on Rafah. After years of community debate in Hobart, the statue of William Crowther has been cut down by protesters. The former Premier of Tasmania was suspended from medical practice in 1869 over charges he mutilated the remains of Aboriginal man William Lane. William Crowther was one of the several colonial figures involved in the now discredited science of phrenology that some believed affirmed European superiority over other races. The Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre's Nala Mansell says the community has long awaited this moment.
Today is a great day for the memory of William Lenny, whose body was mutilated by this man, William Crowther, because of his race. Today, the Aboriginal community celebrate that justice has been done.
And Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners just warned there that the following story contains the name of someone who has died. Two NRL fans have received lifetime bans after allegedly racially abusing Indigenous players Latrell Mitchell and Cody Walker during a Round 10 game. On Sunday, the NRL received a report from another fan who claimed the two South Sydney players had been targeted by members of the crowd during the team's loss to St George Illawarra the previous night. It then prompted an investigation by the Integrity Unit, resulting in the two spectators being issued with a breach notice under the league's Spectator Code of Conduct. And Federal Labor member Bill Shorten says the Coalition's budget reply was a lightweight presentation and a showbag of slogans and band-aids. Opposition leader Peter Dutton says the government allowed 923,000 migrants into Australia in the last 2 years, but failed to build enough houses to keep up with the rate. Mr Dutton says the Coalition would cut the annual permanent migration rate by 50,000 if elected. Mr Shorten has been an opposition leader and presented a budget reply in 2019 and says he understands what it's like. But he's told Nine's Today show Mr Dutton's policy for migration are not backed up, including reducing international students.
We've already started reducing the number of international students coming here. So to listen to Peter, it's as if nothing else is happening except his what his ideas were. The truth of the matter is that the number of international student visas in the last few months has been reduced by 35%. We're on track to halve the net overseas migration number from where it was in the peak of last year.
Over 30 MPs have called on the federal government to make changes on its whistleblower protection laws, encouraging those who have witnessed injustices to come forward. It comes after the conviction of former Australian Army lawyer David McBride to 5 years and 8 months in prison, with a non-parole term of 27 months. Mr McBride was charged by the Commonwealth for stealing sensitive information and revealing to its journalists. The MPs have also called on the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and the Attorney General Mark Dreyfus to show leniency to Mr McBride. Greens Senator David Shoebridge says Australia needs to change the way it treats whistleblowers.
This is a chance for the Attorney and for the Albanese government to show that they really do care about truth, to show that they are actually in the corner of whistleblowers, and to show mercy on David McBride and give him the pardon that millions of Australians believes he is owed.
And classes at one of Australia's biggest universities are set to be cancelled for a third day in a row as pro-Palestinian protesters around the nation defy orders to pack up encampments. Students in Sydney are considering a similar occupation to one underway at the University of Melbourne, where demonstrators have pitched tents inside a major building with no imminent plans to leave. Demonstrators at Monash University claim 9 students have been accused of misconduct and could face suspension or expulsion. Deakin University in Melbourne has issued directives for students to leave, while the Australian National University in Canberra told students to disband their camp by the end of Friday. Victoria Police says it's up to universities to request police action if necessary. And South Africa is urging the United Nations top court to order a halt to Israel's offensive on Rafah, saying attacks on the southern Gaza city must be stopped to ensure the survival of the Palestinian people. The 2 days of hearings at the International Court of Justice, or the ICJ, are a part of a case brought by South Africa accusing Israel of genocide. South Africa's legal team told the court Israel's military campaign has killed tens of thousands of children and women, destroyed civilian infrastructure and starved the population. In response, Israel's foreign ministry says South Africa is presenting biased and false claims that rely on reliable Hamas sources. The ministry has called on the ICJ to reject South Africa's appeal and to bring what it calls the abuse of the court to an end. A 12-day state of emergency has been declared in New Caledonia, with five people killed in the ongoing violence sweeping the overseas French territory. Nearly 200 people have been arrested since the violence broke out on Monday. The crisis stems from a proposal to grant French citizens who lived in the territory for more than a decade the right to vote in provincial elections. It's caused tensions to boil over, with some groups of Indigenous Kanak people fearing their voices will be drowned out.
We feel oppressed. We are angry. Everything is taking place over there and we are wondering, are we being heard? We the Kanak people?
Meanwhile, government spokeswoman Priska Teveno says calm must be restored.
It is an active minority, but an active minority that is extremely violent, as we can see in the scenes of chaos. And so what's at stake for us now, with the curfew and the state of emergency, which was presented at the cabinet meeting and which will come into force from 8 p.m, is precisely to bring back calm and serenity. It is not linked to the constitutional bill.
Ce n'est pas en lien avec le projet de loi constitutionnel en l'état.
And Slovakia's president says the country's Prime Minister, Robert Fico, remains in a serious but stable condition a day after an assassination attempt. The shooting is the first major assassination attempt on a European political leader for more than 20 years and has drawn international condemnation. Political analysts and MPs say it has exposed a polarised political climate both in Slovakia and across the European continent. Newly elected Slovak president Peter Pellegrini says the Prime Minister is still quite weak following life-saving surgery.
He is able to speak but only a few sentences, and then he's really, really tired because he's under some medicamentation. So, of course, it is very difficult for him. But I had the chance that I came in the right moment when he was able to speak with me a few sentences. But the situation is very critical and we have to give him a lot of energy and think and be positive.
The Interior Minister says the 71-year-old shooter, who police have charged with attempted murder, acted alone and had previously taken part in anti-government protests. And now in sport, three A-League players have been arrested after police say they were manipulated the number of yellow cards they received in matches. New South Wales police launched an investigation in December 2023 into the alleged yellow card manipulation. 6 months later, detectives have now revealed that a senior player was allegedly taking instructions from a man believed to be based in South America to organise players taking yellow cards during matches for money. Investigations revealed a senior player was allegedly taking instructions from a man believed to be offshore in South America to organise four yellow cards to occur during certain games in exchange for profit. Police say yellow cards were manipulated during games played on November 24th and December 9, and also allege unsuccessful attempts were made to do the same thing during matches on April 20 and May 4th. And now for a look at today's weather for this Friday, 17th of May. And Broome over in the west, sunny and 34. Perth, similar conditions and 28. Adelaide today, partly cloudy, 21. Melbourne, showers developing and 17. Hobart, showers, 13. Albury-Wodonga on the border there, sunny and 19. Canberra, partly cloudy, 19. Wollongong, partly cloudy, 22. Sydney, partly cloudy, 23. Newcastle, partly cloudy, 22. Brisbane, shower or two, 23. Townsville, partly cloudy, 28. Cairns, mostly sunny, 28. Alice Springs, sunny, 23. Darwin, sunny, 35. And Torres Strait Islands, cloudy and 29 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
Ah, the very deadly tune there out of Queensland. Out of the small town of Warrabinda, that was Maisha featuring the Warrabinda singers and a deadly cover song of that deadly country song that is Neon Moon. I'm Kerry Lee Harding and you're listening to NITV Radio and we're broadcasting live today from Naam on the lands of the Kulin Nation. And still to come, right here on NITV Radio on this Friday, conversation with Nagaluma songman Patrick Chernside sharing insights into his groundbreaking theatre production, Jabi Flood Country, debuting its tour of Naam later today. And also, ever wondered what is the emotional toll after being on the front line of history? Well, in the program today, Alan Lee from the SBS Newsroom shares his experience reporting on trauma. But first, social and support sectors react to the 2024-2025 federal budget.
You're with NITV Radio.
The 2024-2025 federal budget has left many in the social and support sectors feeling left out. They say this is a budget that falls short of providing what the most vulnerable people in the community need. Sydney Lung reports.
Social services providers say the budget is problematic. They are welcoming some measures, but say the funding allocations are ultimately a missed opportunity. Chief Executive of the Australian Council of Social Services, Cassandra Goldie, says the budget failed to deliver the solutions needed.
It was a diagnosis of the problems we face. A housing crisis, a climate crisis, a cost of living crisis, an inflation challenge, a slowing economy and rising unemployment. But in our collective view, and certainly the view of ACOS, we did not get the solutions that were the right ones for the scale of the challenges that we face. There is indeed a gaping hole in the heart of this budget.
The Australian Council of Social Service says the modest Commonwealth rent assistance increase will still leave private renters on JobSeeker or youth allowance paying more than half of their income on rent. Jennifer Kirkcaldy from the Salvation Army Australia says when things are this bad, the charity sector welcomes any assistance. She also says that not enough has been done to support those in need.
Every day, the Salvation Army works with people on JobSeeker and Youth Allowance who cannot afford the essentials. They cannot afford their rent and utilities. They certainly cannot afford what it takes to look for a job or study. The current rate of JobSeeker is less than $55 a day. Youth Allowance is even lower. And when you have less than $55 a day, it doesn't matter how careful or frugal you are, an individual cannot budget away poverty, but the government could have.
Chief Executive of Single Mother Families Australia, Therese Edwards, says better income support is needed to protect women experiencing violence at home.
So what we have now is women who delay leaving because it's too unsafe or they can't afford it, or they know what will happen. We have one in five women return to their place of abuse and to the hands of their abuser because of an inadequate income support. We know that financial security equates to safety and it's for the mother and the children.
Also feeling the strain of cost of living pressures are aged care workers, who say the budget decision to postpone wage increases for the sector means more staff will be forced to leave. Assistant Secretary of the Health Services Union, Lauren Hutchins, says aged care workers are disappointed and tired.
We have workers who rightly expected that they would have pay increases from the 1st of July this year, and there is no money that's been set aside. In March this year, the Fair Work Commission determined that aged care workers had been historically undervalued in the work that they've been doing. Wage increases were awarded by the Fair Work Commissions to properly value their work. Unfortunately, the government has made a decision to actually walk away from that commitment. That puts huge stress on the sector that is still looking for workers. It puts huge stress on the workforce that is still low paid despite these wage increases. All we're asking for is the government to stand by its election commitment of fully funding and supporting aged care workers.
Aged care worker Karen says it was a difficult night for her and her colleagues.
It's going to ruin us. I'm in a private facility
And we're finding it really, really hard to get people to come in and work now, let alone being told, no, you're not going to get the pay increase. You know, it's been delayed till 2026, and that's just ridiculous. It's hurting everybody that works in aged care.
The National Disability Service says the budget was a missed opportunity for the government to support quality services and much-needed confidence to the sector. The NDS says the lack of targeted measures and much-needed sector transformations is extremely disappointing. CEO of the NDS, Laurie Lee, says the budget failed in providing the sector with what they hoped to see.
We were hoping to see some additional support for the sector for reform, a sector transformation fund. We were hoping to see some measures for workforce and workforce development. We were hoping to see clearer signals around pricing for services, which is inadequate at the moment. So we really genuinely feel that there isn't the things that are needed to assist the sector to deal with the level of reform that the government is wanting.
Ms. Lee says the sector is now calling on the government to provide a roadmap for the future of the sector.
So we're really calling on the government to develop a roadmap for reform, which gives providers, people with disability and governments and other stakeholders the certainty that we all need to be able to plan for the future.
Sophie Cusworth from Women with Disabilities shares the concerns of the NDS, although she also says there are several welcome measures in the budget.
We're encouraged by government's commitment to an NDIS that continues to grow to meet the needs of our community. No one is more invested in the sustainability and future of the NDIS than people with disability. We look forward to co-designing the necessary changes with the agency and ensuring that reforms are led by people with disability, including those most marginalised. We welcome the investment in the reform of disability employment services, but this is only the start of what is needed to respond to the Disability Royal Commission.
Finance Minister Katie Gallagher says this budget is focused on getting the NDIS back on track.
We want the NDIS to be successful. We want people to get the right support. We want the system to work better for everybody, but it cannot keep growing at the way it is currently growing because it will squeeze out a whole range of other supports that people rely on eventually. So this budget's an important one for the NDIS. A lot of work going on about how the scheme operates and all the rest of it, but this, how we manage basically planned inflation, is a key to getting the NDIS back on track.
Also concerned about the budget's implications on sector staff is the Australian Education Union, who say this budget fails to deliver for public schools. The AEU says the budget has failed to increase the Commonwealth share of the schooling resource standard to 25%, despite widespread support from state and territory governments, as well as staff in the sector. Federal President of the AEU, Karina Haythorpe, says the government must deliver on its commitments.
The reality for our members on the ground is that they are working in a system that is starved for the resources that it needs to teach the children of Australia. So what does that mean for our members? We've got escalating workloads, we have chronic teacher shortages, and we have students who have increasingly complex needs who are denied the funding by governments to address those needs. That's creating a workforce shortage, it's creating additional pressure for our members, and it's time that this is resolved.
She says the government needs to change the way it thinks about the costs of education.
Rather than dealing with this in terms of a cost to the federal budget, let's talk about investing. Governments always talk about the cost of education, but we're far more interested in the economic investment, not only in the future of our nation, but the investment in every child's right to have a high quality education and an investment in our members, teachers and education support staff's right to be taking up decent work with not chronic escalating workloads and the resources that they need to provide that high quality education for every child.
Sydney Lang, SBS News.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
That's right. You are tuned in to us mob here at NITV Radio. And I'm Kerry Lee Harding. And we must step aside. But when we come back, a conversation with Nagaluma songman Patrick Chernside about his new show. It's called Jabi Flood Country. And it's actually premiering tonight here in Naam. And the show explores the importance of cultural knowledge and language and the impact of modern development on the land.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and and Mobile.
Right here on NITV Radio. I hope you enjoyed that tune just as much as what I did right here in the studio. And that was Song of Freedom by the Freedom Collective, featuring Patrick Chernside, who actually toured with Songs of Freedom last year, in fact, and is now returning to Victoria in an incredible music and theatre event. It's called Jabi Flood Country. That's actually touring nationally. And coming up next is Patrick Chernside in conversation with Bertrand Tuganami.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Patrick Chernside is returning to Victoria with an incredible music and theatre, Jabi Flood Country. And I'm happy to say Patrick has just joined us on NITV Radio again to give us some insights into this groundbreaking theatre production. Patrick, welcome to NITV Radio again.
Thank you, Bertrand, and thanks for having me back again here. And I'm glad to be on country again. Able to perform.
You spoiled us last year touring the country with the Songs of Freedom, and now you're back with something completely different. Can you explain to us the significance and meaning behind the unique Jabi song form that is central to this performance?
Jabi is considered a traditional and unique song form that is made up of short compositions using simple poetic language that is set to melodies. And those melodies have been formed across different, as you would call, or we refer to as Nyinyiri, song makers or song people that carry this tradition of song language and song lines. I guess a Jabi Flood Country is the performance that is a co-creation between myself and Dr. Scott Rankin of Big Heart and our musical direction and brother Aaron Hopper. Encompasses music, song, story, movement, and digital projections. This time we started in Perth, in the city of Melville, traveled to Lutruwita, Tasmania, and shared in the northwest and in the south at Moona Art Centre. And now we're here on Bunurong and Warawarong country in Werribee.
Where you're presenting. The central to this show is urgencies of the 21st century around climate change and environmental pressures, which is something that's constantly in the news, but no one seems to be doing a lot to contain. What messages are you hoping to convey through your work?
I guess messages of, you know, sharing about the importance of country, you know, maintenance of country and those that, you know, through traditional practices have, you know, carried those, I guess, songs, stories, or even actions out, you know, across the country. And also a traditional practice of connection with, you know, like-minded First Nation and traditional owners across Australia that we, you know, similarly we have shared the message about Songs for Freedom message previously, you know, we talked about and those important messages about incarceration in young people's central and, you know, core to some of that diversion and work is this type of work in the cultural space. You know, connecting our young people to culture, but maintaining that connection with elders and, you know, key leaders in the community also.
Yeah, and you've taken the show on tour around the country. You mentioned a few places earlier. What has the experience been like taking the show and connecting with audiences across different parts of Australia?
It's been a very humbling experience, but also very blessing, Bertrand, as you would imagine, travelling to many different parts of Australia and, you know, sharing cultural experiences of song and dance and other traditions. But knowledge sharing and information and exchanges has been key to that. You know, the story itself in Jabi Flood Country, as I said, yes, tells parts of those stories about the history of my own personal journey, but it captures, as you say, through, you know, visual and arts and digital projections, in a traditional ceremonial sort of encompassing practice also, that, you know, we share that experience and exchange on country, firstly and foremost, as part of cultural protocols.
Yeah.
And then, you know, hoping that, you know, Jabi would develop and then into a theatre performance or show of sorts. But as we are travelling across country, you know, we're hoping that that cultural process in grounding Jabi, connecting to country and people and custodians of the land is, you know, important also.
Yeah, that's very powerful. But let's go back to your the show, the creative process, culture. As a Ngalama man, how does Jabi Flood Country allow you to share stories and knowledge from your own culture and homeland in the Pilbara region?
Some of the experiences I've, you know, shared with others, if I may share, you know, recently in the Moon Arts Centre experience, you know, one of the, I had a few elders of the Palawa Nation and First Nations people of the Tasmanian Aboriginal communities, you know, shared that his experience of the show was so powerful and moving, but, you know, part of his work and movements involved, you know, protection of the rainforest country and environment, for example.
Yeah.
So after the show, he, you know, a cultural exchange occurred that wasn't expected. He gave me a necklace and I, you know, exchanged some boomerangs and traded song and story about some of that. I guess for me, that part of the process, you know, is worth the while of sharing and taking Jabi across country. And promoting it is, you know, I guess part of the process in awareness of what song, story, and connection to country can encompass in changing legislation or other views in community.
Beyond entertainment, for those unfamiliar, how would you describe the powerful emotional journey that Jabi Flood Country aims to take audiences on?
Well, it has changed my life, if I was to be honest, Bertrand, in you know, the work that I do traveling across community, but also back in my own home community representing for and with community, but also I guess the experience of being able to represent for community and sharing those important stories and language and culture, it has been, you know, part of the blessing for me to do this way.
Yeah. Now, before I let you go, I'll come back to your collaboration with other great creators. You mentioned Scott Rankin. They also worked with Aaron Hooper.
Yes.
How did working together allow you to blend the traditional Pilbara melodies with contemporary sounds?
I guess it's been in the, you know, making for the last probably 10 years now. And over that process, you know, permissions and cultural processes has been the very key sort of collaborations. But then developing, you know, permissions and processes with other nations and First Nation communities, I guess, has been that slow and gentle process. And that's a, I guess, you know, part of all the details that we capture along the way, but document through the process of being able to present what Jabi Flood Country is about now. And, you know, those compasses stories that entail about community across all the different nations, you know, where similar issues such as, you know, housing or children and youth, justice, diversion, and other sort of key issues about environment, culture, and connection, you know, through this performance, help us to create more awareness around.
Yeah. And before I let you go, just some closing thoughts or maybe some crucial information we may have missed that's really important to bring to the attention of our listeners.
Yeah. We're having the ceremony, or I guess gathering, is going to be down at the Wurrungurl Durung Community Centre here in Wyndham Vale and on Wurrung Country. Tickets and the links, I think, are at Humanitics, and some of the sites you can find, like wyndham.vic.gov.au, for tickets, and also on some of our other socials, like the Vicart social media and their websites. I guess what will people see is, I guess, a projection of ceremonial, I guess, exchange with First Nations groups, but also an exchange of song, story and dance through movement and digital projections. Free event, as I said, Friday afternoon, 6 p.m. A feed starts and a cultural exchange outdoor event. As we said, it's maybe a bit chilly, but we may have some fires burning. So dress warmly and come down to see the show if you can. Yeah.
Yeah, and I will put the message out there. Patrick Chanside, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us on NITV Radio again. And we look forward to meeting you tomorrow at the premiere in Victoria, in Nam, of Chubby Flood Country.
No worries. Thank you very much, Bertrand.
Too deadly, indeed, right here on 3K, on 3, oh, dear me, NITV Radio. Kerry Lee Harding with you this afternoon. We must step aside for another break. When we come back, a journalist from SBS Newsroom shares his story about experiencing trauma on the front lines of history.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
You're tuned in to NITV Radio on this Friday afternoon. I'm Kerry Lee Harding, and I hope you're having a deadly day. Well, journalism has been described as the first rough draft of history, with reporters often bearing witness to the world's most awful and awe-inspiring events. But what is the emotional toll after being on the front lines of history? History's First Draft is a new SBS news podcast series unravelling the psychological journey journalists undertake to bring us the news. In this episode, Alan Lee shares his experience covering the 2011 Christchurch earthquake.
In 30 years as a reporter, I've worked in lots of places that you could describe as being on the edge. I've worked in Jerusalem, I've worked in New York, I've worked in Belfast during the Troubles, but this really is a community that's on the edge.
On the 22nd of February 2011, a magnitude 6.3 earthquake struck the New Zealand city of Christchurch. ...185 people were killed, including one Australian. Buildings had been weakened by another earthquake the year prior, which meant the damage to infrastructure was major. While some caught fire, others crumbled and collapsed.
This building comes down, you got no chance. Can you all go back there, please? Please?
It disrupted tens of thousands of lives and reduced 80% of the city centre to rubble. Alan Lee was sent there in the immediate aftermath.
We arrived, there was no power. We were among the first media from outside Christchurch to arrive. And there's something very disturbing about driving in on a road that you've driven in on dozens of times and all the buildings have fallen down. We did the breakfast show every day with live reports in. We would then go out into the suburbs, meeting people, meeting emergency workers. Our day started at sort of 4:30 in the morning. We were getting back to the hotel at sort of 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and then working through editing until 1 or 2 in the morning, grabbing a couple of hours sleep, and then starting again.
Journalists are often on the front lines of a major world event, whether it's a war, a natural disaster, or a pivotal election. Journalists play a major role in bringing critical information to the masses. During a natural disaster, they can fulfil multiple duties ranging from providing warnings, assessing disaster mitigation and preparedness, to aiding long-term recovery.
I don't think we can go past the fact that we may well be witnessing New Zealand's darkest day.
Absolutely covered. The one under here, hopefully there's no one in here, but all we can hear is the horn. And across the way, in this building here, there are people trapped and they're trying to get them out.
There's often minimal resources, planning difficulties and tough decisions to be made. But how can seeing and experiencing nature at its worst affect a person? For Alan Lee, his journalism career began when the studio he was working for as an engineer wanted a younger person to present a show.
And so they said, oh, you try it, because I was cheap. And they quite liked it. And so I did more. And then I got a job in radio. And so I was a radio presenter for Several years. And I got dropped in the deep end because they decided to put me on a news program. So I had to learn being a journalist from after being a disc jockey from scratch on the air. So it was a bit scary. Then I moved to BBC and then I moved to BBC television. I learnt on the job, really, because in those days they didn't have journalism degrees at university because it's that long ago.
But even after 30 years, he says no amount of work in the industry could have prepared him to cover something like this.
I think you can. We figured our job was to get the story out there and to tell people what happened, because obviously Christchurch was going to need billions of dollars of help. And so I guess part of our role was to explain to the rest of New Zealand why this was needed. But in terms of can you prepare for something like that? I don't think you can prepare for seeing a place that you know and love being knocked down and being patrolled by soldiers in armored vehicles.
So when something so unexpected occurs, what does a journalist do? News organisations frequently arrive to an incident at the same time as first responders, but have significantly less training for the situation. And so, with no time to prepare physically or mentally for an imminent, challenging working and living environment, what's the first step? Alan was a reporter for Shine TV at the time.
It's lunchtime, and suddenly someone stood up and called for quiet, and he said, "I've got my wife on the phone. She's in the Cathedral Square in Christchurch. There's been a quake. The cathedral's come down." And there was a scrape of chairs. So I called my work, and they said, "Okay, get on the ferry across to," since I was already in Wellington, "get on the ferry, go across to Christchurch. And start filing stuff back." It was madness. So we drove down, and you couldn't help but notice that we were the only car heading south. All the other cars were heading north away from Christchurch.
When a natural disaster occurs, most people spend the aftermath coming to terms with what had happened, surveying the damage and checking on loved ones. But for a journalist, there's often no time to process the situation.
We didn't really have time to think about it. I think there were moments when it hit us in terms of what we're doing. One of the things that happened was CTV, Canterbury TV, their building collapsed. Now, the programme that we made went out on CTV. And I had a good friend who worked in the building. We never found him. We never found his body. And I think that was a moment where it came home to me that it was more than just a news story, because now I'd lost someone that I knew and was fond of. We never found his body, ever.
Sometimes the most affecting parts of a news report are led not by experts, not by politicians or academics, but by individuals, the hairdresser or mechanic who saw everything and felt everything. Alan says those vulnerable human interactions were what mattered the most.
There was one couple that we interviewed, lovely couple. We went to their house and the house had tilted, and there's this horrible stuff called liquefaction that comes up. She told us about how they had both been out at work and there was a big aftershock, and they both said, "Oh no, there goes the more of that horrible smelly liquefaction through our house." When they got home, the neighbours had all got together and cleared it out for them. She burst into tears. I burst into tears, and that was the end of that interview. I tear up now. Excuse me, I tear up now, because it's just, that was the thing that we really noticed, was that people worked so hard as a community. They worked together.
But what happens after it's all over? How can a journalist cope after being granted exclusive access to such confronting situations? Alan says he and his colleague found it difficult to jump straight back into day-to-day reporting.
It felt wrong to be back in Auckland, where all the buildings were at 90 degrees and things didn't fall down unexpectedly. I think Scott and I both felt an element of guilt, because people that we had come to know quite well, you know, some of the rescue workers, they were still down there working those horrendous hours. If a lorry went past, and you know that rumble you get when a lorry goes past a building, that's the feeling that an aftershock feels like when it begins. It just feels like a lorry rumbling past. The rest of the organisation would laugh at me and Scott because automatically we would hang on to the desk just in case.
Alan says he also noticed that even years later, it would surprise him how he could still be reminded of his time in Christchurch.
I took my son to see a silly movie where Los Angeles was invaded by aliens and wrecked. But the architecture of California is very similar to the architecture in Christchurch. It's a lot of weatherboard houses, and I had to leave. It upset me too much. And my son was old enough to leave in there. I said, I'll meet you outside. And I was surprised at that. Well, for want of a better word, I'm not a nervy person, but it just was upsetting me to see something that looked like Christchurch, see it being destroyed, even if it was by green aliens.
Engineers estimate the level of damage sustained in the Christchurch disaster was a 1-in-2,500-year event. And for Alan, he says he hopes covering something so unfathomable has made him a better journalist.
I hope I'm more empathic. I think when you see people who are on the edge experiencing very raw emotions, you have to ask hard questions sometimes, but I hope I've learned to ask those questions in a way that isn't offensive, but that gets the answers that we need. And I think that what we did and what the other media did there in telling the stories of people who were on the edge, it was important and it was valuable and it's part of history, and I'm glad I was there.
You've been listening to History's First Draft with me, Kira Hain. For more episodes exploring the effects of reporting the news on journalists, follow the podcast on the SBS Audio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Well, that's all we have time for today.
I'm Bertrand Tungandame.
And I've been Kerry Lee Harding, wishing you a very deadly, fabulous weekend ahead. Leaving you now with the Baker Boy track. It's called Metagen. You gotta stay right, no problem.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.